The following is provided through the IAAIS Program Share Service.
Hello, and welcome to this week's World Traveler. I'm Leah Blackman with the Virginia Voice. Our first article is from Footsteps, Literary Pilgrimages Around the World. Lake Geneva, as Shelley and Byron knew it, by Tony Perrottet. Switzerland is rarely thought of as a wild artistic center. Most of us recall the harsh verdict of Harry Lime, the character played by Orson Welles in The Third Man, who declared that the country's most creative achievement was the cuckoo clock. It wasn't always so. A few centuries ago, Europe's most adventurous bohemians flocked to Lake Geneva on the Swiss-French border to savor its inspiring mountain scenery and liberal political climate. The most notorious group arrived from England in May 1816, led by the 28-year-old celebrity poet George Gordon, Lord Byron. Having earned the moniker Mad, Bad, and Dangerous to Know, thanks to his debauched behavior and operatic romances with men and women, including his half-sister, Augusta, he was fleeing England in the wake of a scandalous separation from his wife. His mode of transport was a replica of Napoleon's coach, and with him were a bevy of footmen, his personal physician, an emotionally troubled young doctor with a bookish bent named John Polidori, a peacock, a monkey, and a dog. He and his entourage were met in Geneva by a fellow group of literary wanderers helmed by the struggling poet Percy Bysshe Shelley, who, by the age of 23, had gained his own notoriety in England as an advocate of atheism and free love. He was accompanied by his brilliant and beautiful 18-year-old mistress, Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin. She married Shelley later that year, and her alluring stepsister, Clara Claremont. Also 18, she had been Byron's lover back in England, and for a time Shelley's. It was Claire who had orchestrated the holiday meeting in Switzerland when she heard that Byron was traveling there. Byron and Shelley got on famously and soon decided to rent adjacent summer houses in the hamlet of Cologne, about 4 miles north of Geneva. Byron took a grandiose villa with his doctor and servants, while Shelley, Mary, and Claire settled into a more humble house by the lakefront. The coterie was the most brilliant and romantic circle of poets, writers, and personalities which Switzerland and Europe has ever seen, wrote the historian Elma Dangerfield in Byron and the Romantics in Switzerland, 1816. The claim may be a little overblown, but there is no question that it was a dazzling alignment of talent. When the group wasn't sailing on Lake Geneva or making horseback excursions to medieval castles in the Alps, they were writing. That summer produced Mary Shelley's Gothic classic Frankenstein, or The Modern Prometheus, an array of revered poems from Byron, including The Prisoner of Chillon, and a sinister short story called The Vampire, written by John Polidori and inspired by Byron, who would years later influence Bram Stoker's Dracula. Hoping to get a sense of how Lake Geneva inspired such creativity, I spent a week last summer tracking down some of the places in which the romantic poets spent their time, a task that entailed visiting one ravishing lakeside village after another. Croissant-shaped Lake Geneva is the largest, deepest, and bluest of Swiss lakes, and its beauty is only heightened by its surroundings. thriving vineyards, historic architecture, and in the distance, peaks dipped in snow all year round. The winters are mild and the summers hot and dry, earning it the title Swiss Riviera. There are even palm trees by the eastern shore, and the water is warm enough to swim from pebble beaches from June to September. But for me, it was a legacy of Byron and the Shelleys, and the juxtaposition of such larger-than-life characters in such a pristine, buttoned-down place that gave Lake Geneva its most powerful allure. Because Cologne, where Byron and his coterie stayed in 1816, is primarily residential, I took a small apartment in a slate-gray cottage high above the fashionable town of Montreux on the far eastern side. As luck would have it, the Montreux Jazz Festival was in full swing when I visited, and the waterfront promenade, normally lined with quiet gardens and cafes with majestic views, had been transformed into an open-air mall, with the well-heeled crowds moving between booths selling handicrafts, clothing, and edible treats. Jazz and every other musical genre wafted through the warm night air, although finding live events was a challenge, since they are mostly held in pricey indoor venues. Instead, I got a shot-sized glass of local wine, carefully measured out at 1 deciliter, found a Brazilian DJ in a bar overhanging the water, and lost myself in the tan throng. Climbing the 343 steps back up to my cottage, I reminded myself that, bon vivant though Byron was, he didn't come to Switzerland for the nightlife. The next morning, I headed straight for the water. Lake Geneva, at 45 miles long and nearly 9 miles wide, is so well served by impeccable Swiss railways that one can get from almost any point to another in less than an hour. A network of elegant antique ferries also plies the lake for more leisurely excursions. For my voyage, I waited for one of the paddle steamers, which date from the Belle Époque. Mary Shelley raved in her letters about the near tropical color of the lake, blue as the heavens which it reflects, and used an array of scenes from Lake Geneva and Frankenstein. Today, many of the views of tiny villages and coastal crags are unchanged, although Byron and his friends, who traveled in open sailing boats and along rutted carriage trails, would be astonished at how the once impoverished Swiss Republic has become one of the wealthiest corners of Europe. In my polished ferry was a mint-conditioned dining room of inlaid walnut paneling and fine linen, so I took lunch in aristocratic style, gazing at the terraced vineyards while sipping Swiss Sauvignon Blanc. After a 2-hour boat ride and 20-minute hop by train, I arrived in downtown Geneva, now home to United Nations bureaucrats and bankers. Back in 1816, Byron and Shelley had seen no reason to linger here. Byron complained in a letter that he was followed about his hotel garden by staring boobies, or, more politely, English tourists. So the two groups relocated to the secluded farming village of Cologne near Geneva. Byron to this spectacular Villa Diodati, and the Shelleys to the more modest Maison Chapuis just below. A short bus ride took me past the Jet d'Eau, Geneva's trademark fountain, to the manicured main square of Cologne. Today, the village is essentially a Geneva suburb and one of the most exclusive residential addresses in Europe, divided into the magnificent estates of chief executives, sheikhs, and assorted celebrities. As I strolled past iron fences and hedges, security guards and glass booths eyed me with frank suspicion. To my relief, I soon spotted Nan Chemin de Ruth, where the word Diodati was discreetly engraved into an antique stone gatepost. The salmon pink villa is still in private hands, now divided into luxury apartments, but there are good views of it from the street and the public park next door. Its exterior has changed very little from the depictions in 19th century engravings, including the expansive balcony where Byron finished the third canto of his epic poem, Childe Harold's Pilgrimage. Although the vineyards that once tumbled down to the water are now flower-filled gardens, and Maison Chapuis is gone. The gate was open, so I blithely strolled into the estate, intending to knock on the door. As I drew near, I could easily imagine the Bohemians of 1816 gathering by candlelight in the upstairs dining room to debate and carouse. Byron's initial resistance to resuming his affair with the dark-eyed Clara did not last long. "I never loved her, nor pretended to love her," he later wrote. "But a man is a man, and if a girl of 18 comes prancing to you at all hours, there is but one way." Sexual tensions festered as Dr. Polidori fell in love with Mary, and wild rumors began to spread among English visitors to Geneva. Curiosity seekers passed by in boats to peer at the women's underwear on the washing lines, evidence, it was believed, that the Villa Diodati was a virtual bordello. Others would stop Byron on his evening rides to accuse him of corrupting the local girls and youth. The whole Swiss setup, one British newspaper reported back in London, was a sordid league of incest. But the summer of 1816 was historic, not only in a literary sense. A huge volcanic eruption of Mount Tambora in Indonesia in 1815, far more powerful than Krakatoa would be 68 years later, sent a pall of volcanic ash across the northern hemisphere, bringing so much cold weather and torrential rain to Europe that 1816 was nicknamed the year without a summer. In Switzerland, it was mid-June when the freakishly bad weather began, and almost perpetual rain, Mary recalled, with terrific thunderstorms rippling back and forth across the lake. Wine flowed copiously, as did laudanum, a form of liquefied opium. One night, when Byron read aloud a haunting poem, Shelley leapt up and ran shrieking from the room, having hallucinated that Mary had sprouted demonic eyes in place of nipples. It was in this surreal, claustrophobic atmosphere that she experienced the famous nightmare that became the lurid plot of Frankenstein, as she later recounted in the preface to the 1831 edition of her book, about a scientist who creates a creature from stolen body parts and infuses it with life. The next night, she told the gloomy fable in the Villa Diodati to a rapt audience. As visitors do today, Byron and his cohort loved to explore the lake. When the rain finally ceased, Shelley and Byron set sail for a week-long literary pilgrimage of their own. The first stop was the village of Clarens, where the most beloved novel of their era, Jean-Jacques Rousseau's love story Julie, or The New Heloise, was composed and set. In Lausanne, they paid their respects to the house of Edward Gibbon, where he penned his revered epic history of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. It was already a ruin and would be knocked down in 1896 for the Lausanne post office. On their way home, the pair was caught in a storm that broke their rudder and nearly sank their boat, presaging the sailing accident that would end Shelley's life 6 years later in Italy, since despite his love of boats, he never learned to swim. But the highlight of the trip, according to Byron's letters, remains one of Switzerland's most thrilling attractions, the Château de Chillon, a medieval fortress whose turrets rise dreamlike from the waters. The castle became notorious in the 16th century as a political prison, and the two poets were deeply moved when a gendarme showed them the dungeon where an outspoken cleric, Francois Bonivard, had been chained to a pillar for 6 years. For my visit, I strolled the 2 miles along the lakefront from Montreux. Ferries also make the journey. The dungeon is still a major attraction, as is the pillar where Byron's name is carved. Although Byron's friend, John Hobhouse, who traveled with Byron later in the summer and revisited the castle in 1828, believed that the inscription was made by a drunken guard to attract sightseers. Stairs lead up through endless chambers, many with traces of the original medieval frescoes, into the highest keep, where every arrow slit offers a stunning lake view. After their visit, Byron and Shelley stayed at a guest house in Ouchy, the port below Lausanne, where Byron stayed up late into the night writing The Prisoner of Chillon, while Shelley worked on his Hymn to Intellectual Beauty. Today, Lausanne is the most spectacular and vibrant city on Lake Geneva, whose steep hills, crowned by a Gothic cathedral, can be ascended without strain in high-tech funiculars. The old waterfront inn still exists, although it has been expanded into a glamorous business hotel, the Hôtel d'Angleterre, with blood-red velvet armchairs and contemporary art on every wall. But perhaps the most evocative relic from 1816 is one that was entirely deserted when I went. The mansion of Madame de Staël in Coppet, whose salon was the only one in Switzerland that Byron would deign to attend. The formidable 50-year-old de Staël was famous in Europe for her best-selling novels, her collection of famous lovers, and her outspoken liberal politics. She was exiled from Paris by Napoleon in 1804, and her soirees attracted the greatest minds of Europe. Today, the chateau, a 5-minute stroll from the railway station, remains in the family. The 10th generation owner, Count Othonine Dawsonville, age 79, lives in one section, but opens many rooms to the public. These are filled with the original furnishings, including Madame de Staël's personal bathtub and pianoforte. Fascinated as the Romantics were by the spiritual power of untrammeled nature, not even the self-absorbed Byron could visit Switzerland without experiencing the Alps. At different times over the summer, he and his cohort made grueling excursions by horse and mule to be totally overwhelmed by the sheer scale of the peaks and waterfalls, the rumbling avalanches, and the unearthly glaciers, like a frozen hurricane, Byron wrote admiringly in his journal. The most ambitious alpine jaunt was undertaken by Byron and his visiting Cambridge chum Hobhouse into the breathtaking Bernese Oberland. But while Byron and Hobby spent days on horseback, the trip can now be made in a few hours on one of Switzerland's most stunning train rides, which climbs from Montreux to Interlaken in the German-speaking region. The panoramic carriages offer sweeping views from Mount Bovon over the whole of Lake Geneva, then delve through tunnels and switchbacks into the heart of the Alps, where the three signature peaks of the Jungfrau, Eiger, and Monch loom like a lint chocolate box cover. Even the tormented Byron seemed to enjoy himself in this celestial mountain scenery. On one occasion, crossing a high pass, he apparently lightened up so much that he made a snowball and threw it at Hobhouse, reports Alma Dangerfield. And on finding a lush glade, I lay down in the sun, enjoying myself most entirely, Byron wrote to his half-sister, and dared to write down in my pocketbook that I was happy. The climax came at the village of Lauterbrunnen, stunningly set in a deep gorge lined with waterfalls, one of which Byron described as the tail of a white horse streaming in the wind. Today, Lauterbrunnen's dramatic setting is entirely intact, although instead of lodging with the local curate, as Byron and Hobhouse did, I took a room in one of many efficient bed and breakfasts on the main street. For the next few days, instead of hitching a mule, I rode cog railways and cable cars high above the clouds to hike along breathtaking ridges, then return to the village for fortifying cheese fondue dinners. One morning, I got up at dawn to enter a tunnel carved beneath the Staubach Falls, just outside town, and gazed out through the torrent at the surrounding mountains, while slowly being soaked by glacial spray. Who, I thought, needs laudanum? In the age before contraception, free love worked better for men than for women. The Diodati idol went awry in August when Claire revealed that she was pregnant. Is the brat mine? Byron wondered gallantly in one letter, before reluctantly concluded that it must be. The Shelleys departed for England on August 29, while Byron promising to support the child. He lingered on at the Villa Diodati until the beginning of October, but finally left Switzerland for Italy to throw himself deeper into sensual abandon. In retrospect, the Frankenstein summer seems a fantastic interlude of happiness in lives marked by tragedy. In 1822, Percy Shelley drowned in Italy at age 29. Dr. Polidori had committed suicide the year before at age 25. Claire's daughter with Byron died at age 5, and only one of Mary Shelley's 4 children with Percy survived. Byron died in Greece in 1824, at the ripe old age of 36. The last survivor was the audacious Claire Claremont, who lived to age 80. At the end of her life, she started a bitter memoir denouncing the practice of free love, which, she says, turned Byron and Shelley, the 2 finest poets of England, into monsters of lying, meanness, cruelty, and treachery. The scrawled pages were discovered in 2009 by the biographer Daisy Hay in the New York Public Library. Today, such morbid ruminations are hard to sustain in the brilliant light reflecting from Lake Geneva. On my last night in Montreux, I headed down to the jazz festival and drank as many thimblefuls of wine as I could afford. Carpe diem. Byron and the Shelleys surely would have concurred. For how many summers do we have? That was Lake Geneva, As Shelley and Byron Knew It, by Tony Perrottet. A poem by Lord Byron, George Gordon. She walks in beauty. She walks in beauty like the night of cloudless climes and starry skies. And all that's best of dark and bright meet in her aspect and her eyes. Thus mellowed to that tender light which heaven to gaudy day denies. One shade the more, one ray the less, had half impaired the nameless grace which waves in every raven tress, or softly lightens o'er her face, where thoughts serenely sweet express how pure, how dear their dwelling place. And on that cheek and o'er that brow, so soft, so calm, yet eloquent, that smiles that win, the tints that glow, but tell of days in goodness spent, a mind at peace with all below, a heart whose love is innocent. That was She Walks in Beauty by Lord Byron. From Byron's Childe Harold, Canto 4, verse 178. There is pleasure in the pathless woods. There is a pleasure in the pathless woods. There is a rapture on the lonely shore. There is society where none intrudes by the deep sea and music in its roar. I love not man the less, but nature more. From these are interviews in which I steal from all I may be or have been before to mingle with the universe and feel what I can ne'er express, yet cannot all conceal. To a Skylark by Percy Bysshe Shelley. Hail to thee, blithe spirit, bird thou never wert, that from heaven or near it pourest thy full heart in profuse strains of unpremeditated art. Higher still and higher from the earth thou springest like a cloud of fire. The blue deep thou wingest, and singing still dost soar, and soaring ever singest. And the golden lightning of the sunken sun, o'er which clouds are brightening, thou dost float and run, like an unbodied joy whose race is just begun. The pale purple even melts around thy flight, like a star of heaven in the broad daylight. Thou art unseen, but yet I hear thy shrill delight. Keen as are the arrows of that silver sphere, whose intense lamp narrows in the white dawn clear, until we hardly see, we feel that it is there. All the earth and air with thy voice is loud, as when night is bare, from one lonely cloud the moon rains out her beams, and heaven is overflowed. What thou art we know not, what is most like thee? From rainbow clouds there flow not drops so bright to see as from thy presence showers a rain of melody. Like a poet hidden in the light of thought, singing hymns unbidden, till the world is wrought to sympathy with hopes and fears it heeded not. Like a high-born maiden in a palace tower, soothing her love-laden soul in secret hour, with music sweet as love, which overflows her bower. Like a glowworm golden in a dell of dew, scattering unbeholden its aerial hue among the flowers and grass, which screen it from the view. Like a rose embowered in its own green leaves by warm winds deflowered, till the scent it gives makes faint with too much sweet those heavy-winged thieves. Sound of vernal showers on the twinkling grass, rain awakened flowers, all that ever was joyous and clear and fresh, thy music doth surpass. Teach us, sprite or bird, what sweet thoughts are thine. I have never heard praise of love or wine that panted forth a flood of rapture so divine. Chorus hymeneal or triumphal chant, matched with thine, would be all but an empty vaunt, a thing wherein we feel there is some hidden want. What objects are the fountains of that happy strain? What fields or waves or mountains? What shapes of sky or plain? What love of thine own kind? What ignorance of pain? What thy clear, keen joyance languor cannot be? Shadow of annoyance never came near thee, thou lovest, but near new loves, sad satiety. Waking or asleep, thou of death must deem things more true and deep than we mortals dream, or how could thy notes flow in such a crystal stream? We look before and after, and pine for what is not. Our sincerest laughter with some pain is fraught. Our sweetest songs are those that tell of saddest thought. If we could scorn hate and pride and fear, if we were things born not to shed a tear, I know not how thy joy we ever should come near. Better than all measures of delightful sound, better than all treasures that in books are found, thy skill to poet were, thou scorner of the ground. Teach me half the gladness that thy brain must know. Such harmonious madness from my lips would flow, the world should listen then, as I am listening now. That was To a Skylark by Percy Bysshe Shelley. That's all for this week's World Traveler. I'm Leah Blackman for the Virginia Voice. This program is also available on demand at www.virginiavoice.org.